dealing with our verses here. That Pete pointed out something. There was a, I know all of you are anxious about this. There was a misparsing there. That first one, the while consecutive there at verse 19, should be a cal perfect, which converts it, the force of the while consecutive, essentially converts it to an imperfect. If it were the other way, it kind of converts it back to a perfect. So we'll make that change in the notes, though. So again, here, reading our verses, thus Babylon, the beauty of the other kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will become as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation. Nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there. And we left off here, I think, with point 19. This verb, this noun rather, gaon, for pride. It's used in both the good ways and bad ways. But it's used here in the sense of arrogance or haughtiness. And then 20, it should be understood in the latter sense of pride and arrogance here. And the phrase, the pride of the Chaldeans, should be taken to mean the pride the Chaldeans have and have manifested in the construction of this great nation. And there's no doubt, I mean, the language that's used even in these prophecies is that there's no question that Babylon is a great nation in a lot of ways. But again, one of the problems with success and prosperity and all of that, number one, is it makes people soft. And you see in the life, say, of Nebuchadnezzar, the premier Babylonian, we might say, that his success and all of that went to his head. And he was convinced that he'd done it all, that I have, and if you read his little statement there, is this not Babylon the Great, which I have constructed for the glory of my majesty, and all that is I. And well, God broke him of that. Tough way, but he broke him of it. So again, we'll see the Babylon's called here the beauty of the kingdoms. It's a kingdom that's admired. In another place, it's called a golden cup in the Lord's hand. In another place, it's likened to a debutante who's always enjoyed the best of all things and lives a life of luxury and ease. So many things indicate, again, and then we see all the economic things about it, that it has got this great standard of living and all these things are in it. And they are imported largely from around the world. Again, our deficit, our trade deficit, just continues to grow. Because we consume much more than we produce. And that's just a fact. And that is also, by the way, the sign of a nation in decline. There are many little symptoms that you could look at economically, militarily. We've stretched our military so thin and so under-equipped these people. And the dirty little secret is when they all come back, you know, that they're not treated right. Even when they come back from warfare. So the reality is, of course, the nation is again, rightly so, proud of certain things. But it gets into arrogance, and the lack of God's not a part of this, and we've done it all ourselves, is the mentality that God's going to destroy. So these two terms here may well have been chosen because they both have two nuances. One that deals with glory, beauty, or majesty, and one that relates to pride and arrogance. And the latter, of course, is the reason for Babylon's judgment. We saw that in verse 9, but Proverbs talks about this in a general sense, I believe. Proverbs 16. Pride goes before destruction. And a haughty spirit before stumbling. So why does God hate this sin so much? Well, obviously, one, it was the first sin ever committed. It is characteristic of Satan and his view and his world outlook and all of that. Led to his destruction and ultimately will lead to it still. I mean, he's in the process of undergoing his five falls, which correspond to his five boasts found there in Isaiah. So he's constantly falling in that sense. And then we saw it in our chapter, Isaiah 13, 9. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming. Jeremiah 13, 9. I'm sorry. No, it wasn't in our verse then. That explains that. All right. Jeremiah 13, 9. Thus says the Lord, just so I will destroy the pride of Judah and the great pride of Jerusalem. And Americans ought to stop and ask themselves, if God will do this to his own people, his chosen people, his covenant people, which he picked out of all the nations of the earth, not because they were bigger, stronger, smarter, or any other factor. He obviously picked them for volitional reasons. But if he'll do this to his own people, how does this nation think they're going to escape? And again, a fundamentalist said it years ago, and it's always kind of stuck with me. If God doesn't destroy America, he's going to have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. Because we're every bit as bad. And again, while people argue, well, the world is no better than we are. No, they're not. But they're going to get there shortly afterwards anyway. So don't think people are going to escape this. So this is why if you want God's regard, if you want God to smile on you, to favor you, to bless you, to grease your skids as you go through life. And he's not always going to make everything easy for us. That's not the goal of the Christian life. But if you want his blessing, you better be a humble and contrite person. And you better recognize exactly how far short you fall of God's glory. All of us. I mean, this is for everybody. The tendency towards pride is something we all have to watch out for. Some of us are more prone to it than others, and you know who you are. I won't single you out. I'm one of them, so that's why I'm not singling anybody out. Whoops. So here, while one cannot debate the fact, point 22, that the United States is a beautiful place, having great cities filled with beautiful architecture, a successful economy, a wonderful cultural attractions. I mean, Sarasota's the cultural capital of the world, if you think they think they are. That's the arrogance of people in this town. That they think they're just all that in a bag of chips. You know, this isn't Broadway, by the way. You know, when you go to the Golden Apple Dinner Theater, it's... I've never been to any of them, so I can't say, but I'm pretty sure it's not Broadway. And people are proud, and sometimes rightly so, and other times it's just an overreaching arrogance. They're just not as good as they think they are. Well, and we have many other attractive features. I mean, the beach is in Sarasota. Now, one thing we can boast about is the beach. But what did we do to accomplish that? Well, nothing, other than maybe trying to keep it clean. I mean, they do that. So, one cannot debate that such has resulted in an overreaching arrogance among its leadership and people. And more specifically, even than the people, the leadership is arrogant in this country. And you see this all the time. I mean, they parade it on the news all the time. Well, the Hebrew term 23 here, kasdim, refers to the, that's Chaldeans, refers to the genetic racial stock of the Babylonians, who occupied the land of Ur as early as the time of Abraham. Now, Abraham's dates are 1950 to 1775, and that place was already known as Ur of the Chaldeans. And so that's the cradle of civilization over there, Mesopotamia, you know, the city, the place between the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. And when you see that word again, Akkadian, I've referenced that, I think, actually up in point 10 on the root. That's these earliest civilizations, the Sumerians, the Akkadians. Sometimes it's you'll find it in text as Akkad, A-K-A-D. You'll find it as A-G-A-D-E sometimes because of phonetic things in the Semitic languages. So they were there early on. And 24, while it may not be popular or politically correct, the racial stock that originally settled prophetic Babylon came from the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes. And the word Angles was applied to the people and their language. Again, it's anglicized, but it's English. And that's where we get our language. So 25, one can readily argue that the formation of the United States was the single greatest accomplishment of these people and became the pinnacle of their glory. And in a certain sense, you can understand this, rightly so, that this is their greatest accomplishment. But unfortunately, the nation has deteriorated. And it has deteriorated first and foremost spiritually. And all the things, again, that we have done that have essentially kicked sand in God's face, as it were. Now we're building this structure of evil up into the heavens where God's got to deal with it. And he will. And it's not going to be pretty at all. Well, 26, however, all the splendor and majesty of the nation will not deliver it in the end. The latter part of verse 19 specifies that the destruction of Babylon will parallel the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And 27, the destruction of Babylon is likened to that of the two most notoriously evil cities of their time. And they're the names that are singled out, but the cities of the plain were all kind of engaged in this stuff. Sodom and Gomorrah may have been the worst of the worst. But the cities of the plain were all destroyed, except for one of the little ones, I think. So, which indicates that the reader should consider the cause and nature of that horrendous judgment. Sodom and Gomorrah were in the most prosperous region in Canaan at that time. It very much parallels what we have. We are still, to this very day, I think, the most prosperous nation on the planet. Now, it's all built on a house of cards, to coin a phrase. And a little stiff wind's going to blow the whole thing over. I mean, the economic system in this country is so tenuous because we live in so much debt. And that's why your average Babylonian parallels their government. In that regard, most people are in debt and stay in debt. Now, I'm not talking about debt where you have to, you buy a house and you're in debt. Okay, most of us don't have, well, I was going to say 70 or 80,000, but that was the old house of a price of a house. I had come and buy a Clark, I noticed, in a new house starting from the low 550s. Oh, I have a half a million. I'll go get one. I don't. All my savings, all my life, if I cashed in all my insurance and everything, they paid, I died, and I'm worth more dead than alive, financially anyway. And I still couldn't buy one of those houses. And again, this is a very wealthy area. I get that. There's a lot of retirement money here, a big retirement money. But who can afford it? Well, we're still in the most, again, I think if you ask many people around the world, where would you want to live? It would be America. So Genesis here, 13:10. So when Abraham tells Lot to separate from him, Lot lifted up his eyes. Lot makes a choice. And Lot here very much manifests his negative volition as a believer. He makes his choice on what's financially best for him at that moment. The present advantage is all he's looking for. He doesn't care about the long-term scheme of things, SG3, those kinds of things. Eternal rewards, pleasing God. He's not that interested in that. Lots of monetary reversions. And so very much like the people of, most people, Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. And then Moses inserts here a comment, parenthetical comment. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. It was like the Garden of Eden, essentially. Like the Garden of the Lord. Like the land of Egypt, as you go up to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself. Now that very well sums it up right there. Chose for himself. Looking for present advantage, how can I get the best out of all of this? For my temporal satisfaction and blessing. And that's all he's concerned with. And he chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. And thus they separated from each other. Now Abraham settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Then you have this sort of ominous note introduced. Now, the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. And so, this is not a smart move. And people do this, all the time. In our country still, for jobs and temporal advantage, they'll relocate, they'll leave local churches and go off and do their thing. And for more money or fame or whatever it is they're pursuing. And as I pointed out, it's sad, but a lot of jobs are just not compatible with Bible doctrine. I'm sorry. There's just too many of them that take you out of class too much. And especially in the last days where we're under the command all the more, as you see the day approaching. We're not under the command to try to do it less. And theoretically, I suppose, if I thought it was worthwhile, or we could, and I don't think I'll ever do it, but, you know, it wouldn't hurt necessarily to have another Bible class. But we got to have time to live our lives and get the material and apply it and all that. But I am of the opinion you probably can't have too much doctrine. That's my view of it. But I'm just kidding, we got lives we got to lead and all that. So, it was these cities, again, declined into evil, despite their economic advantages and blessings. And see, while many have sought to rewrite history, we get a lot of this revisionist history that goes on. And so, again, realize that what's being taught to your kids in school today is very much revisionist history in many ways. And does not really express what has gone on in the world. They want to rewrite it and clean it up. And I was watching, I'd read the book, I mean, ways back, but they had an old movie, an old version of 1984 on the other day. And then there was a quote that Orwell had in the book, I believe. And that is, he who controls the future controls history. And he who controls the present controls the past. Because you can rewrite the past to suit your deal. And that was what this guy Winston Smith in the book, that's what he did. He was constantly changing facts to suit what they said the new facts were. Because they're at war with Eurasia. And we've always been at war with Eurasia. And then they go to war against this other, and these other people are our allies. Well, then they go to war with these people, and Eurasia's always been our allies. And they just rewrite history, and he would go through, you'd see him, he's sitting in his little cubicle there, and he'd just rewrite the facts to suit what the government was saying. Now, that's not what our media does, though. Oh, wait a second. Yes, it is. The media rewrites the facts to suit our government and to suit the businessmen of this country, to suit the businesses. And again, there's this unholy alliance, because guess where they get all their revenue from? The media. Ad sales. And so you want to have this relationship, or they want it. And they're not willing to tell people, oh, by the way, this drug will kill you. No matter what they're telling you, please don't take it. And so they constantly change things. And if you can do that, well, I guess you think you can change history. Well, you can't. So those who sought to rewrite history, the new modern rewriters of history, have said that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was failure to show hospitality. That is ridiculous, for one thing. First, why would Lot have been in their city and become a great man if they failed to show hospitality? He came in from the outside. As a matter of fact, they even referenced that. Genesis chapter 19. Here. So as many have sought to rewrite history, the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was largely sexual deviance, as illustrated in their attempted homosexual rape of the two angels. So Genesis 19, 4 and 5, and before they lay down, Lot had invited them into the city, and they were going to spend the night out in the square. They were going to stay out and sleep in the common area. And Lot knew that was not safe. Lot knew what would probably happen. So he urged them strongly in verse 3, and they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Now, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." And that's a nice way, that's a euphemism. The Hebrew verb, yada, to know. And that's one of the ways it's used, like Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth. So it's a euphemism. It's used that way. That's one of the way that verb is used for sex. And in here, homosexual sex. So they said, bring them out so that we may have relations with them. And I think, let me check here, the Christian Standard Bible. Let's see, what do we got here? The first one is the Jewish Bible, the complete Jewish Bible. Translate this, bring them out to us, we want to have sex with them. Now that's as plain as you can make it. And that's what the Hebrew is saying here. The Christian Standard Bible, send them out to us so we can have sex. The English Standard Version's more literal, bring them out to us so that we may know them. We just want to get to know them. We just want to talk. Well, that's not what they wanted. So let's see here. We may know them. Where are the men who came? What is going on here? Why does this keep changing? Versions there. The Jewish Publication Society, there's as we may know them. We may have relations with them. That's Ron's. That's also the New American Updated. That's what they've translated it as. And of course, the issue there, of course, is sexual relations. And this isn't popular in today's world because we're supposed to embrace this deviance. We're supposed to say, well, this is just your choice. It's just an alternate lifestyle. You're fine. We'll support you. You should have the same rights as every normal married couple. No, you shouldn't. This is deviance, and if you don't know it's deviance, there's something wrong with you. They said, well, okay, we want to bring them out because we want to have relations with them. But Lot went out the doorway and shut the door behind him and said, please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. And so again, they tried to say here, well, this is just, they wanted to come out and have fellowship with them, and they didn't show good hospitality to these guys, and so God wiped them off the planet. Well, that first, that doesn't hardly seem like, failure to show hospitality is maybe not good, but I wouldn't really classify it as exceedingly wicked. The words that are used of their behavior is not consistent with, oh, I didn't invite you over. That's not consistent with this. So I have two daughters, and clearly what's meant here by what he says is obvious. I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you and you do whatever you like. What a dad. Father of the year, Lot. Only do nothing to these men inasmuch as they've come under the shelter of my roof. And they said, stand aside. Furthermore, they said, this one came in as an alien. And already he's acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them. So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. Well, the angels miraculously just jerk him in and deliver him. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. Again, I don't know. Now, Lot's daughters, I don't know what they thought when he said that, but thanks, Dad. But at any rate, they didn't have to do it. So again, what's happening here? This is homosexual rape is what it is. And nine, the populace was not expecting the judgment and was taken completely by surprise. In fact, those in Sodom thought the idea of judgment, that judgment could fall on them, was laughable. That's found in verse 14. Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who were engaged to marry his daughters. And he said, up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be joking. Nah, good joke. God's not going to destroy this place. And that's how many Americans feel today. We're above all of it. That our nations can't ever change. That it's not going to be subject to God's judgment. But it is. The judgment was sudden, apparently lasting less than one day. The Lord was the agent of destruction. He's the one behind this, verses 24 and 25. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. And the best guess, of course, here is that the valley of the Jordan ran down and now it's under the southern part of it. It's under the southern end of the Dead Sea. That's why that sea is so saline. And I can't remember what the salinity of it is, but I mean it's way more than like normal oceans, the Dead Sea. Apparently, you go there. If you can't even swim, you can't drown in this place. You float, you know. So you're so much more buoyant in this. And of course, that is probably a good location for it, as near as I can tell. And nothing, you know, that's not habitable. So the destruction was so complete and devastating that those cities and the surrounding area were never inhabited again. Note that believers were delivered before the fact, but only if they complied with the warning. That's in verse 29. Thus it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley that God remembered Abraham. See, Abraham's intercession for Lot is the backdrop to all of this, and that's recorded, I believe, back in chapter 18. And sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. Church will be delivered at the rapture prior to this. But for those believers, people that become believers after the rapture, their life's going to be very difficult. They're going to have to leave this place if they intend to survive. They will not survive if they stay here. So 28 here, now verse 20 continues to describe the nature of that overthrow in terms of the population or lack thereof, which will characterize Babylon after God's judgment. It will never be inhabited again or lived in from generation to generation. And that's, again, parallel statements that are designed to reinforce this synonymous parallelism is designed in the Hebrew to reinforce the first statement by recasting it in different words. But the same thought is there. Never going to happen. Just says it in a couple of different ways. The two statements about being inhabited and lived in are somewhat parallel. However, the first verb, yashav, should be understood in a more limited sense than the second verb, shakan. The sense of both being used together is that there will be no temporary inhabitants in Babylon. There will be no permanent inhabitants either. So all the permanent inhabitants, they're not going to dwell there anymore. They're not going to live there. And temporary inhabitants, people who come that Airbnb, and all the people that come on the cruise lines and that come to see the sights, go up to see the Niagara Falls, although only part of that's in our country, but and see the Statue of Liberty and all those things, the Empire State Building. Oh, think of all the things in America you'd like to see. The Grand Canyon, some of those tremendous formations, rock formations out there in Utah. I've seen the Atlantic and I've seen the Pacific. The Pacific, you don't want to swim in, it's cold. And I remember thinking as a kid, oh, this is great. We'll be able to get, because I was used to the Atlantic. We lived in Delaware and, you know, the Gulf Stream runs up by there and the water was pretty nice. I mean, in the summer anyway. As a matter of fact, we were talking about both Pete and I had went to the same beach. Well, not at the same time probably, but who knows. We both went to Rehoboth Beach up there in Delaware. And I remember that as a kid. So there are things you might want to see. You might want to go see the St. Louis Arch. I don't know. Maybe you want to see, some of the big domes they built. Maybe you want to see the world's biggest ball of string, collection of aluminum foil or, whatever it is. There's a lot of attractions that bring. You want to go to, the Grand Ole Opry. Some people like that. There are people that like to go to Branson. I'm not sure why, but they do. I mean, there's a lot of entertainment there and all that, So there's a lot of things to see, and there's a lot of reasons for people to come here. And there are a lot of, but that's not going to happen any longer. Again, there's not going to be any temporary and no permanent inhabitants. They're all going to be gone. 31, the use of the preposition ad, as far as or until, is designed to deal with the future and is often used to denote a perpetual state. And this is confirmed by the two usages of the noun door, generation, which means exactly as it's translated here, generation to generation or generation after generation. However you want to translate the wow there is not really significant because the sense of it is the same. There's not going to be, and this is the problem, there is no future generation. The sound of the bride and the bridegroom are gone. We are living in the last generation that's going to inhabit this country. There's no doubt about that, I think. Question is, how long can it all hold together and last? But you talk about the saturation of evil, our economic policies, the things the insiders are doing, the unholy alliance between the government, the businessmen, and the media, and you've got a situation that's only getting worse. The politically correct takeover, I have to admit it, for quite a few years I stopped watching South Park because it stopped being funny, but the last couple of seasons have been kind of funny because they introduced this guy called PC Principal. And he is an idiot. And so he's always out there doing the politically correct thing. But the other day, one of the ones I saw, you know, the kid that ran the school paper, the principal told him, you can't print that. And he goes, yes, I can. The freedom of the press is guaranteed under the Constitution. And he said, no, but this isn't politically correct. And he said, well, I don't care. So this little kid stands up to him. It's all kind of funny. But it's, unfortunately, it's too real. It's sad because it's so true. Generation after generation here pretty much reflects that this is it. And 32, the final two statements of verse 20 reflect the reverse of what was stated at the beginning of the verse. The idea of pitching a tent, a longer or settled stay, is followed by the transient idea of shepherd resting his flocks for a short time. I think in all of these here, I think probably Yashav is generally means to settle down. But to pitch your tent can be used for, again, a longer stay or a shorter one, because, you know, Lot pitched his tent as far as Sodom. But that's where he ultimately settled. So it becomes, it's not necessarily just transient, because it uses the idea of tent. 33, while this passage indicates that Babylon will never be inhabited again, one key reason is the fact that no one in his right mind will have any desire to approach North America because of the fear of her torment. We saw that in Revelation 18. They will not come near. And so all this idea, you still hear him carrying on. Relief for Puerto Rico. Well, still, that's a late date now. They still don't have power to half the island. And if you think that devastation was bad, that was just a warm-up for what's coming here. There's going to be no way to ever rebuild everything. I mean, if the EMP is probably going to fry everything. You'd have to completely redo the whole electrical grid if you could, even. So they can't. But Revelation 18:10, they are standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment. They're afraid of getting involved with this. They don't want any part of it. And saying, whoa, whoa. So if you're thinking Red Cross, no. If you're thinking any foreign relief aid, no. The United Nations, well, they're not going to be doing so well at this time. So they're not going to send any help. The World Health Organization, no, forget that. You can forget about anybody even coming close. And number two, what is said in a couple of places, it isn't just that they're afraid of coming. They don't care. They stand about and hiss. They make fun of this after it's over. You deserved it. And they're not inclined to want to help, even if they had the resources to do anything. They would not be inclined to want to. Which, again, we've created this juggernaut. We've got these nations out here that we've run over all these centuries now, a couple of centuries. And violated our word. Treaties are good. Treaties are great. Just ask the American Indians how that worked out for them with all our treaties. And if we think Russia is keeping treaties, you're very misinformed. They've broken almost... And this is not new news. This is not recent history. This goes back that they've acknowledged that Russia has largely violated every treaty it's ever made. But that kind of fits in with their character, doesn't it? What we see here in this matter of how they view all this, their brutality. Well, why would they care about keeping treaties if they're willing to slaughter millions of people in an instant? They're not worried about treaties. So here, 33, while the passage indicates it will never be inhabited again, one key reason is nobody's going to want to. And they recognize this. They say this: in 1 hour, your judgment has come. Within a space of 60 minutes. It says 1 hour of one day. In some places it says one day. It says other one place it says an hour. They're complementary. There's 24 hours in a day, and one of those, one fateful hour, is all it's going to take for the destruction to occur. And then 34, the fear of radiation poisoning and the inevitable death that follows will be a sufficient deterrent for those who might consider a visit to the Western Hemisphere. And I think we've got time. Let's go ahead and we can get, I think, at least the exegesis done of these verses here, these last two, verses 20 and 21. But desert creatures will lie down there, You got a wow adversative here, plus the wow consecutive with the cal perfect here of Ravats. Rabhats. 30 times this word's used, it means to lie down or to rest. You probably have noticed this adverb has been repeated in that last verse a couple of times, and it's going to continue to be repeated. There's a big emphasis, this adverb sham. There's a big emphasis on there, in that place. Sham, actually. Adverb sham, in that place. There. It keeps emphasizing there, in Babylon, where all this takes place. In that place, desert animals will lie down there. As it says here, let me see, let me get to my verse here, 20, or 21 rather, I'm sorry. But desert creatures will lie down here. And then you have this term, masculine plural noun of sea, T-S-I-Y. That means what belongs to dry places. Literally desert animals. Desert animals will lie down there. Will lie down there. And their houses will be full of jackals. And is a wow here, consecutive with the cal perfect. Malay, M-A-L-E, apostrophe. Malay means to fill up, to be full, or to make full. To be filled, masculine plural noun construct with the third masculine singular suffix of bayith. B-A-Y-I-T-H. And that word means exactly that, houses. Houses of them, their houses. Of howling animals. These appear to be canines. And these words, I will tell you, the words used here to describe these animals are all rare words. They're very difficult to trace out. So we'll do the best with them we can, but we have some idea of what kind of animals inhabit desert places already. We're familiar with the idea of jackals and hyenas and wolves and coyotes and mountain goats and all of that. And the birds, owls, buzzards, carrion type birds. And we're going to be introduced even to the ostrich. So desert animals will fill their houses. Their houses will be full of desert animals. And their houses will be full of owls. Owls is this masculine plural noun here of okay. Apostrophe O-C-H-A. Oka, actually. It's a furtive patak. You probably are going to die away like at night, sleep, wonder. What's a furtive patak? Why is it furtive? And what's it doing there? Well, that's just a way of the. It's a the vowel usually does not come at the end of a Hebrew word. It usually ends with a radical. But in this case, sometimes they do. This is only used one time, so it's real difficult to trace this word. But it appears to mean howling canine animals like jackals or coyotes. So their houses will be full there of owls. And so they've translated it as owls here. Ostriches will also live there. So ostriches, and that's why you're going to see a bunch, if you look in other English translations, you'll see a wildly different translations for these words. Because they're just very rare. So ostriches will also live there. And will also, to pitch a tent, you've got that verb we saw in the previous verse, shakan. Means to pitch a tent, to reside, to live in a place. There, adverb sham again. And daughters of the ostrich or emu, literally, offspring. You have this Hebrew feminine plural noun construct, bath, which means daughter, literally. The daughters of or offspring of, and then this word, ya-anah. Y-A apostrophe A-N-A-H. Yeah, and eight times only in this construction appears to mean ostrich or emu, those types of birds. And shaggy goats will frolic there. So you got this word here, and as a wow connective here with sair, S-A-I-Y-R. The root comes from the word meaning hairy. Goats, and again, this would probably include wild goats, wild sheep, things of that order. Some of those things that inhabit, and if you watch them on mountains, I mean, they're just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. In the way they can navigate this stuff that, you know, humans could never do. So it appears to mean that, and shaggy goats will frolic there is the PL imperfect of Rakad. R-A-Q-A-D-H. Had to make sure that wasn't another race there. I'm getting... the race and the Dalith look a lot alike, so you have to watch that. Occasionally I'll miss one. Nine times it means to spring, leap, or dance about, hence to frolic. And then our adverb sham there again. Hyenas will dwell in her fortified towers. The wow consecutive with the cow perfect of ana, A-N-A-H. The verb here can mean apparently two things. The verb means to dwell someplace, to live, apparently, or sing. And given the fact that it's hyenas, sing might be okay here. For their constant yipping and all of that. But we'll leave it with what they've got here. Hyenas will dwell. And then you've got this word, E-I-Y. Jackals, hyenas, wild dogs, apparently. And then prefix bait here, in her fortified towers. You got the inseparable preposition here, plus this word, alman. Apostrophe A-L-A-M-A-N. This word means widow, but the term for fortresses and strongholds has a resh in the place of the lamed. So there is some textual question here. We'll deal with that. It doesn't materially, any of the textual questions here are not materially going to be changed what's being said here. What's very clearly being said here is that animals are taking this place over. This will be a zoo, which is kind of ironic because it's kind of a zoo now. I mean, all of this is kind of dripping with irony. You got jackals in her fortified palaces, in her luxurious palaces, in her fortified towers. Well, what do we have? Right now, we have this in our highest offices. We have men of no moral character whatsoever to speak of. That whatever they're doing, they're not doing it in the best interest. And of course, this is all the rhetoric you always hear from the politicians. I'm just here to serve the people. And yet, the people largely go unserved. Go figure. So, if we're missing, you know, say, according to Rumsfeld a while back there, if we're missing $2.5 trillion from our budget, that would go a long way in solving a lot of the problems in America. But that's, unfortunately, it was lost. So, what can we do? So, hyenas will dwell in her fortified towers, or fortresses. And jackals in her luxurious palaces. Tan, again, also appears to mean jackals, hyenas, foxes, feral dogs. These words, again, aren't used much. In her palaces is actually hekal. H-E-Y-K-H-A-L. And that word means exactly that, palaces. What are we going to have at Mar-a-Lago? Who's going to be living in Trump Tower? And I'm just talking about him, obviously, because he's the focal point and he's in the news and all that. But there are these people. I mean, who's going to live in Tiger Woods' house? He's got a pretty nice place, I bet. You know, down all that expensive property down there in South Beach, which, by the way, if you happen to catch the news, they can't keep replenishing the beach and it's gradually eroding. And you looked at all these deals and there was like a stretch of beach maybe 10 feet wide or something, or 20. Is all that's left. When that erodes away, property there ain't going to be worth much. Sadly. But I don't think we're going to have to worry about erosion here. So in their palaces, and then you have this masculine singular noun that means soft or delicate. It's the word oneg, apostrophe O-N-E-G-H, oneg. To be soft or delicate, I have to look at that one too. The noon and the gimel are so similar. So they translated it here as luxurious, in her soft palaces. Luxury kind of connotes it better, I think. Her fateful time also will come soon. And is Kai. And then you got this masculine singular adjective, Karov. K-A-R-O-B-H. Karov denotes proximity in time or space, so it's often translated as near, soon, or shortly. And they translated here is soon. Soon to come, literally in the Hebrew. You've got this prefix lamed with the cal infinitive construct of the verb bo. Soon to come. Her time. A common singular noun here of eth, E-T-H. Actually, eighth. Is that's a sarah there. Specific time. And in context, the time that's coming is her time of her destruction. That's what's on its way. And as we see, the day of the Lord is coming to accompany all this. But this occurs just, of course, just previous to that. So her, and they put the word here fateful, because it's recognized as a critical time for her history. Her critical time is coming. And her days will not be prolonged. And is a connective wow here with the masculine plural noun of the typical word yom, for days. Her days, and then the negative lo, L-O apostrophe, will not be prolonged is mashak. M-A-S-H-A-K. Mashak, this means to draw out, hence to extend or prolong. And that's how they've translated. Her days will not be prolonged. That there is a time on God's prophetic schedule for all of this. Just as we know there's always a time for everything in God's plan. Even Solomon, of course, acknowledged that. Now, man may not always know the time. That's part of the problem of humanity. We don't know God's timing in everything. But there's a time for everything. A time to sow, a time to reap, a time to laugh, a time to cry, a time to hunt for stuff, a time to give up hunting for stuff. And so, while there are times for these things, in order to be happy and adjusted, you got to kind of figure out God's timing. And that may not be our timing. I don't know why, but sometimes God doesn't seem to think that my timing is the way we ought to do it. So I don't know where he gets this. But maybe because he's been around a lot longer and he's God. And maybe I don't know as much as I think sometimes, of course. That's evident. So this is all going to come to pass, and it'll come to pass in God's time. And nothing's going to stop it, and nothing's going to extend it. And that will be it. Okay, well, good. We did get through that. I've only got about a minute left here, so that's fine. I'll give you a minute off. Won't even charge you. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity of fellowshipping in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth, and we certainly pray for the soon return of your Son to deliver us from this mess, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.